The series is on race and culture, and my name is Molefe Tsile. I introduced myself quite extensively a week ago, and I realized that many of the people who are here came this week. It unfortunately may not be possible within this few minutes to do that, to make a personal introductory background. But we'll pick up some of these things in our discussion. There will be about four sections of this series of race and culture, and it would do you good if you are able to attend all four. The first one, I would be exploring the issue of race and culture. And most of it will be reflecting my own experience, or how I encountered the issue of what you call racism. And it may be possible that in the course of this discussion, we can also share your own views about it. And I can mention that most of what I'm going to say will be drawn from my experience in South Africa. And it would do us good to hear how that those types of things are reflected in the American situation of race and culture. And I can mention also that there will be a panel discussion with myself, Mudiehi, and another volunteer staff who is a white South African on the issue of non-racialism in South Africa. That is the society that professes non-racialism, and it will be a panel discussion. And on Saturday morning, I'll be developing an ethics that tries to deal with the issue of different races, what is called hospitality to the stranger. And I believe that it is an important Christian model or Christian response to the issue of racism. And then I will try to take a few points that are raised in this new approach to ethics of hospitality to people who are different from us, what we call a stranger. And what does that mean? And in practical terms, what does that mean? For today, I'm going to be very provocative, deliberately so, about the issue of race, because this is one of those issues that you, a person of my generation cannot deal lightly. Whether we like it or not, our lives and the stories of our lives are lived out in a black or white world. We are going to try and develop such an understanding of race and racism, or race and culture, so that we can be able to live with it creatively. I think it will be dangerous to try and overlook it. It will be certainly tragic to presume that this issue of racism is not an issue in our lives. Because even to those people who do not really, it doesn't matter much, it remains potentially an issue, because the day they interact with people who are different, it will just come to the surface. And it will not help either to say that by discussing this type of an issue, we are raising, we are resuscitating or resurrecting old and buried skeletons, which many people would wish to forget. Our purpose is to develop the insights that will enable us to live and work in a multiracial world. And unless we are able to understand these things properly, we cannot come to terms with the world in which we are today, which is a multiracial, a diverse world. The problem of race and culture is as old as the humanity, or as old as the times when people of diverse backgrounds came in to interact with one another. Racism can be cultural as between the Greeks and the Romans when they first met, where the others believed in intellectual or philosophical superiority, the others believed in military or physical might. It could be religious as between the Jews and the Samaritans after the exile period and even during the time of Jesus Christ. It could be racial as between blacks and white. And perhaps the best well-known forms of racism is Nazism, which led to the Second World War. It's apartheid in South Africa. And to some people, they would say that another modern or contemporary form of racism is what is called Zionism. There is a debate about that, because the people who profess Zionism think that they are being misunderstood, whereas the Palestinians, they think that there is nothing, no way of explaining Zionism except that it is a form of racism. I don't want to get into that debate, except to mention that to other people, Zionism is another form of present-day racism. A few months ago, I happened to speak at the graduation ceremony of a small Lutheran school on the south side of Chicago, which is called Martin Luther Education Center. It's being run at a church, which is, I think, a Missouri Synod church, but it is a predominantly, if not 100%, a black school. They invited me to come and speak at the commencement, at the graduation. And as part of my speech, I made certain observations. I must mention that the purpose of my observations were to motivate these young people who were graduating to begin to be what I wanted them to be, a little bit more critical. But also, I wanted them to try and find ways to motivate them to break out of the cycle of accepting failure and dropping out, which is very common on the south side of Chicago, where many young people just feel that once you have gone through grade 8, it's not necessary to go beyond above, because in any way you may not get a job or whatever they think. Now, as part of my presentation, I raised a number of critical questions in my graduation speech. Basically, I said to them that why do statistics, and these are the questions that I will also ask today, why do US nation statistics show that more young blacks end in jail, that more become involved in violent crimes, that more are busted for crime and drugs, that more die before the age of 35? And I asked, why is it the case that more young girls drop out of school because of pregnancy, teenage pregnancy, and similar type of questions? And I wanted to capture them, and having done asked that those questions, I tried to show that education can make a difference if they take it seriously. After the address, one lady came to me when we were having a cocktail, and she said to me, she advised me that I should not or should never ask such questions in America, because she said, here in America, there is no black or white criminal. Here in America, that thing which you know from South Africa, don't bring it here. I really politely listened to her. But unfortunately, it was very difficult at that point to really accept. I didn't really argue with her. But it brought to me certain statements that as a black South Africans, as a black South African, normally come when you meet people. I want to test these statements to you and let you reflect whether have you ever heard those statements being said by somebody, and how do they come across when they are said to you? Because for us, for me, let me preface this. These statements are mainly South African statements, which you hear from white people. Just ask yourself, what do they mean? And there are various forms. Some of them are very direct, some of them are very camouflaged. But listen to them. One of the popular statements that I hear people like me here in South Africa is this: our blacks are happy. The problem is people like you who come to put ideas into their heads. Many foreigners who went to South Africa would know that they were actually, when they asked white people, they would tell them that. Our blacks are happy. The problem is people like you who put these ideas into their heads. Now, there are a number of things in that statement. I don't know, I'm not going to analyze them. Number two, look at the mess the whole of African states are in. Why can't they improve the conditions of their own people? Not sure how many of you have heard that statement. Number three, this is very common. I am not a racist. Don't misunderstand me. And in fact, some of my friends are black. But, just hold it there. But, it's just that some of these people are difficult to live with you in your neighborhood. I personally am not a racist. Actually, some of my friends are black. But, it's difficult to live with some of these people in your neighborhood. They must become a little bit better. They must qualify. They must prove themselves to buy a house next door. Somehow like that. Listen to this one. They need us. They can't make up their minds. You must help them. And they don't know what they need. You must show them. Normally, when I go to a shop in South Africa, to a supermarket, I'm trying to see whether should I buy this jacket or that, and an assistant comes and say, take this one. It just comes to my mind that that thing that I can't make up my mind, I must be helped. Some of them, as I said, are very direct, like this one, that, well, you know, they are noisy and they are dirty, their neighborhoods, and they don't mind it. When one of the incidents which happened, I was sharing with some people yesterday that we have most houses is one room which you'd subdivide with curtains for the mother and the father to sleep here, the brother and sisters to sleep here, and so on. And it was interesting that when we were in prison and we were staying in single cells, one of these prison authorities said to us, you must be thankful that you are actually having a room to yourself, a cell to yourself. You don't have this at your township. And actually, even saying that, we find it strange. In other words, if you stay in a big house, it's like you take an animal and put it in a clean surrounding, it will just find itself in a very strange place and make it dirty. Those are some of the statements. This other one is also very popular when you were on the issues of money. They are more comfortable with the money they get. If you give them more, they get confused and it disrupts their lives. They end up not even coming to work. It's one of those which are used when they survey why do black people why are they being paid little money. Normally the employers will say, oh, they are happy with this money. Once you give them more, you're actually destroying them because they won't even come to work. Now, these are just typical statements that I say that you come across them. And some of them are very direct, like a person who just says that these people are not full human beings. And some people who say, no, actually they are full human beings, but not for my daughter to marry, to get married in them, or not for my son to marry in them, and so on. Now, what actually is racism? One dictionary describes racism as the dislike of any people who are lumped together as an inferior race. But it doesn't only end at the dislike. It results in attempts to limit the economic opportunities of those people, to preserve the status, and to deny equal protection under the law. And racism is most likely arises between people, rather between groups that show obvious physical and linguistic differences. And among those groups, it is even more likely to persist. And it also arises in situations where political and economic interests or gains are under threat by others. Where economic and political interests are being questioned, racism emerges. Therefore, issues of racism has to do with superiority claims, that we are superior. It has to do with segregation, and it has to do with justifying a certain status or economic or political position. How do you justify that you are at a higher interest, you say, because we are of a different race than those people and so on. So there's an ideological justification in that. Now, let me share with you something which is very interesting, that in South Africa, racism, when it started, it was actually between different religious groups. For an example, the law stated that you may not marry a person of a native on religious ground that is of a different religion. And as a result, whenever the natives were converted to become Christians, the law allowed them to marry other Europeans. But the more and more natives became converted, the more they became Christian, the shift changed. Now it became that you can marry on the segregation became more status education based. For example, there was a time in South Africa where black people who had a particular education level were able to vote. There is what is called qualified enfranchisement. You had to qualify to be a member. You could be discriminated if you were lower. But later on, it became a pure black and white issue. So therefore, one can see that the whole issue of race or racism, it involves a number of things. The important one being that it happens in context of where there are economic and political interests at stake, and people will begin to raise the issue. And racism also is an ideology, and as an ideology, it presupposes a viewpoint of the world and of life that is tainted by a perspective of the viewer in a very dogmatic and totalitarian manner. For an example, where a person tries to see everything on the grid of color line, whether black and white. Whether there is crime in the world, he apportions it according to whether it's black or white, and so on and so on. So it has this ideological force. And when it occurs, racism takes advantage of the apparent differences between people. It could be color differences. It could be linguistic differences. It could be educational background differences. It could be religious differences. And where those differences do not exist, where people do not have those differences, racism will create them, because it's important. Otherwise, how are you going to justify being superior to others? For example, take France. Essentially, events leading to the French Revolution, when you study the society there, all those people were French people. But if you see, if you get a novel like Tale of Two Cities, they might as well be living in completely different countries in terms of the aristocracy and the people there. But yet all those people were all completely same national people in terms of language, culture, religion, etc. But something had to be brought up which justified that. One can look at the situation in India, for example, the racism in India, which is called the caste system, which is amongst Indians, some of them mostly of the same religious background. The same system exists in Japan, which also is very, very severe, to the extent that up to today in Japan, if you are to marry, some families who take this seriously will employ a private investigator to inquire the background of the girl you're going to marry. And if that background is from a family which is not clean, sufficiently clean, then the parents will oppose that marriage. So there is still that discrimination. Or it can happen in Britain, where it was justified according to the class of the royalty, but it started as estate owners who became the lords and the ladies, and those who owned no estate were down there, and so on. Now, unlike race, culture acknowledges the differences without employing these in power struggles or power relations. Because culture basically refers to the ways of living that are characteristic of a particular group, whether that group is geographic or generational or whatever. Like, you can talk of a youth culture or an African culture in terms of geography. Now, for an example, the best example of differences in culture which do not really go to the level of racism is the differences in language. There are many people acknowledge that the French and the German speak different language, but nobody claims that any of them are superior on the basis that they speak different language. There's no claim for superiority, and even to use the fact that we speak this language, then therefore we are more. And also, unlike race, culture can be assimilated. And also through education, one can be socialized into a particular culture. For an example, it is very easy to learn European culture, to learn European ways of life. Even if your physical appearance do not become European, but you can, for all intents and purposes, be a European in terms of the culture that you have, the way you dress, the way you speak, the way you eat, etc., etc. So these are the differences, significant differences between race and culture. But it's important that where nothing else can accentuate the basis for racism, where nothing else exists that can accentuate the basis for racism, then culture will be used. The differences in culture will be used to claim superiority, racial superiority. It is important to distinguish between an individual and society, and the society in which he or she is situated. Now, this question of the differences between an individual and society is very, very important, and I think it's even more important for the American society. For an example, the question of being a what I may call a non-racial person, but staying in a racial society. How do you cope with that? Take the South African society. We know that there is what we call apartheid. But does that make everybody in that racist society a racist? As individuals, how do you relate the issue of an individual who is not a racist, but the system in which you live? Could be the school system, the legal system, the prison system being racist. Now that tension between the individual and the society in which you live. In other words, sometimes racism can become can find life no longer so much amongst individual, but also among the laws of society. Could be in the church, for example. Could find a racist church, but the pastors are very themselves as individuals. They have nothing to do with racism, but the church still remains racist. Now, I think this is one of the important things that we should actually look into as we explore this whole issue of dealing with issues of racism and culture. And I'm going to, there is this other issue which is being debated amongst amongst the black people in America. They are asking this question, and I'm not sure how you'll respond. They are asking whether can a black person be a racist, assuming that he is not in power, he's not having power. Their argument is that in order to be racist, power, interest, and economic interest must be involved, status, etc. But if, for an example, a person like Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam talks about black Muslims, is he a racist? And within that context, what is reverse racism? Something that is also called reverse racism. That is, the racism of those people who were once victims of racism, but now do it in return. And can it occur in the context where those people are still not yet having power? For example, can you talk about black people being racist today in the situation where they cannot vote, they're still, etc., etc.? These are important questions that are related to racism. Now, let me conclude by this question, rather this remark, that the best means to counter racism is to recognize it as a power force, not as something that is merely in the imagination of people. Because people tend to think that if you leave it on its own, it will die a natural death. But racism needs to be fought, and you fight power with power. And that is why people are saying, let us not assume that people will employ black people. Let us put a law that makes sure that they employ them. Let us not assume that people will avail houses to minorities. Let us institute a law that will see to it that happens. We can look at many ways. For an example, one of the important issues which I did not mention here is the whole issue of power relations or discrimination on gender basis, because that also is part of this entire power struggle, except that this time it's against the sexes. And that is why people believe that you should protect, you should encourage, you should fight that racism by laws through legal means, and you must also encourage ways that fight them by legal means. So therefore, in this case, you use power, legal power, or congressional or constitutional power to fight racism. And I would be interested in your response on this so far. Thank you very much.
Oh, why not? I have problems with the word racist, I think, because it is such a broad brush type of label. As an adjective, I think it works. To call a person a racist suggests a complete dismissal of that person as a person. And therefore, the reverse is also true. If you're not the most blatant kind of redneck race supremacist, then you can't be racist in your attitudes. And I guess, in my own experience in working in the city of Newark, in the State University of New Jersey, where we have a great many black students in the student body, and I have anything to do with that kind of racism associated with black people, there are other kinds obviously too. And in dealing with faculty there, I less and less believe it's possible to be untainted by racist attitudes when you work in a racist structure, particularly if you derive privileges from that structure. I think it's very difficult to avoid attitudes, if nothing else, indifference to the real problems of racism. But that's different from being an overt race supremacist. There are degrees and varieties of these things. That's why I have a problem with that word. But when people have said to me, teachers have said, I work with the composition program for 8 years, the freshman writing program, and race issues come up frequently because they're connected with language issues in the writing program. And teachers would, and I hire teachers, teachers would come to me over and over and say, oh, I'm not racist. I mean, that's one thing I had to do in hiring teachers, was try to detect whether or not they're racist or not. That's not easy to do. And yet they would say no, they weren't. And then the things they would say, the attitudes they would have toward students and language and politics just didn't sound right to me. And I didn't know what to label. I don't know if I call them racist either, but I didn't want to hire them. So there are a lot of subtleties involved in that whole thing, and I have problems with that.
Of course, the accusation is very stinging to say a person is a racist.
A racist.
I use it with care whenever I have to use it. But I have no doubt in my mind that there are people who are simply that. I mean, I've read these statements, you know, about 9 statements of typical comments that you hear. The other day on television, they were showing the changes that were happening in South Africa. And there was this one person who was saying that no, we can't open our swimming pools to these people. And said, no, making some, of course, the comments are clearly racist in the sense of being insulting, you know, like they will spread AIDS in the swimming pool, you know, and so on. But some are very subtle. And I'm interested in the most subtle comments. One of the lecturers at the university in South Africa studied in Chicago, graduated in PhD, went back to South Africa to work. And he was employed by this big university in Pretoria called UNISA as one of the few black people ever to be employed there. But because he came from Natal in another province, South Africa, he had to get a house in the nearby area, and therefore you had to go to a black township. So the university takes one professor there and say, go and help Dr. Goba here to go and get a house from the local authorities, what you call municipality authorities in the region of Pretoria. Now they go to the first place. As he went to the first place, this professor arrives. I am Professor so-and-so. I've brought this doctor, Goba, here. He's being employed by University of South Africa on the hill, and he wants a house. Can you help me? Now, he says that manager, that township manager, there was Dr. Goba here, and there was this professor. he ignored him. He took him out of the picture, and he spoke to this professor. He spoke to him through this professor. You tell Dr. Goba, we work according to procedure here. You tell him, he was here. You tell him that he must put in his name and so on, and we will do everything to help him. And then they moved out. Now this professor says he was very disturbed by this clear apparent racism in this person, who just didn't even acknowledge that this person is a doctor. If they didn't even speak to him. They went to the next township. As they arrived to the next township, the same thing happened. I'm Professor so-and-so. I've got a doctor here who is going to work at the University of South Africa, and you're looking for an accommodation to him. This fellow says, I'm really glad to deal with you, doctor. We want many people here, and so on and so on. And anything I can do, here is my telephone number, ring me. And they went out. And as they went out, Dr. Goba made a comment to this professor, and he said to him, "Is the second man I'm worried of, not the first one. The first one I can deal with him because he's very open to me. He's the first man. I'm not sure where he stands." Now, it was an interesting comment, which when you read the statements, which are common responses, that some people would start by saying, "I'm not a racist, please don't get me wrong," but continue to behave like that. Now, I'm not clear about the exact final details of how this other second man that he says he was more worried about than the first one, he may have behaved in some manner that got him worried, but he says that he's more dangerous to him because he doesn't show it. Now, that is where the problem is, that as I say, one can acknowledge that to be called a racist is painful. But it's important not to be lulled into believing that we are not. And also, it's important to begin to question, this relationship. What do we do if we on our own are not, but the systems in which we live are racist? They could be the legal, so on. And I've already indicated that is why it's important to fight for that legislation that counter that. But you have a situation where people take it for granted that it's not even necessary to put this in the Constitution. We're not racist.
I was just gonna sort of respond to all that. I think it's important to understand the role of ignorance and all of that, in distinguishing prejudice born of ignorance from racist convictions. You know, racism is, like we said, no one wants to be a racist, but some people are willing to acknowledge that they're prejudiced, or that because maybe they just have stereotypes because they don't have any direct experience with people of a different race, they just have stereotypes. And that would distinguish between racist and non-racist, is those who are willing to challenge those stereotypes by learning or overcoming their ignorance. And I mean, but then on the other hand, there's those who, through even more knowledge and trying to overcome ignorance, hold on to those racist convictions. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems that there is, in that way, you can see some degrees of racism.
I have a trouble, like you, with the word racist. It's a label. It's not an act. And then that's a problem. I guess I see discrimination as an act. I understand racial discrimination. It's one of the many discrimination acts that we have. I have a nephew who's blind. He's discriminated against. His dog, who leads him around, is discriminated against. I think we need to look at, focus on the act, not the label.
Can I respond to that? I think we do need to do that focusing very much, because that gives us a concrete point at which to fight these things or to get good legislation into place. But the acts are merely the tip of an iceberg, And what's beneath that is a racialist ideology. And it's the invisible attitudes and the assumptions that people hold that they may not even voice about race that are even more dangerous than the laws or the lack of laws. Because as long as those attitudes are there and that ideology is there, whether it's underground or whether it's institutionalized by the state, whether it's a racial ideology or patriarchal ideology, whatever it is, gains in the law can be eroded very quickly, at least in a country where there's the power to change laws quickly. Those things can disappear. Ideologies tend to have a lot of staying power more than rules and regulations do. So I'd say we should do that, but we can't forget about what's supporting it, what's holding it up, those things that stick out above the water. And I think they're bigger than the act.
Yes?
I'm a school bus driver, and I substituted for the call in Milwaukee, 220 program. Those little kindergartners, black ones, they were on the bus 2.5 hours for 2 hours of kindergarten. Now, is that helping them educate them? Putting them in a suburban school, white school, or integration? I don't think so. An adult would have to meet them at the home. Here, the mother at noon would come out in her white negligee and meet the child. And what am I supposed to think then? Some of the mothers ask not to send them, they choose to send them to a suburban school. All they ask, how long is the bus ride? The longer the bus ride, the better.
I don't know whether do people who go into integrated schools or who have an experience of being educated in integrated schools, do they think that their perception of racial differences becomes, or say their tolerance so much of racial differences become better than those who didn't? I mean, anybody who has an experience of that. Because I would imagine possibly the policy could be behind that. Possibly, I'm not sure whether educationists have proved that it's better in the long term for children to be educated.
They found that out by 10 years already. They found that the education part isn't any better.
Uh-huh.
Education.
Because if I to make a follow-up, in South Africa, we are thinking along that of passing children to integrated schools, because we seem to think that part of the heightened tension of racial is because of children have a completely different experience from kindergarten up to university. Now, that is why I say that anybody who thinks that from his own experience, does it makes any difference?
I think sometimes racism is taught in the homes too.
Mm-hmm. Our children went to school in Washington, D.C., and they integrated every class that they were in. The education was really poor. There was no library, no science program, no music program. But what they learned in human relationships and understanding of other races just was so much more value than what they got out of books. So I'm very grateful for their 8 years in that kind of setting.
It seems to me that, from my observation, the first very small step for white Americans, or at least white suburban Americans, away from racist attitudes is that they now consider themselves colorblind, that they will no longer perceive that there is a difference between white and black. And what that ends up meaning is that very often white suburban Americans pretend that the black people they meet are white suburban Americans. And if you have black children going to a white suburban school, and the teachers are doing the same thing, and they're reading about Dick and Jane, or whoever it is now, and Dick and Jane are white, and the families are white and support suburban, and there's never any discussion of differences in culture, positive differences in culture, then you're, I don't see how that could benefit anybody. but celebrating differences in culture, it is bound to be a benefit to people of any age.
You wanted to share. Thank you. Oh.
See, I was going to say that I don't have any grandiosa words because I deal with five-year-olds. So we keep it pretty simple. And I teach five-year-olds, and I don't know, I've always felt very strongly about the family of man, you know, all on the earth. And the thing that is so frustrating for me is where I'm at, there are only white-skinned people. And although a lot of those people have different, you know, heritages, I know at school I try to introduce my children to different cultures, but it's not the real thing, and it's very hard. You know, I wish there was something I could do, and it's frustrating to me because, like always in January, I make a real focus, you know, as a Black American month or Black month for learning about the Black people around the world, but primarily those that are American, you know. And we also try to deal with, you know, the Asian cultures and then the Native Americans and on and on and on. But it's just, it's so frustrating to me because it's not real. My children may, you know, the only time they might ever see a person of another skin might be when they go to Portland, which might not be very often, maybe not till they're 7 or 8. And so it's kind of like, I get real frustrated with it. Because I think that when you're around people of different cultures in just a very natural way, you're not afraid. But those situations for some of us don't happen. And when I travel back to visit some of my family that are like in Indiana or Ohio or Kentucky, and I'm very surprised at some of the things that they say about people, and I'm ashamed. And I don't know what to do about it. It's frustrating to me. And I wish I had the answer, you know. And I think that sometimes it's just, like you said, or like Mike Lowe said, that presenting different heritages, different cultures in a positive way, trying their foods, hearing their music, their cult, their stories, their literature, seeing the different ethnic dresses, even though people don't dress that way all the time, you know, having a respect for that. So I don't know. It's frustrating for me, as you know, but not as painful as it has been for you.
Well, I'm very interested in some of the things that you talk about that don't compare black and white. I think that, at least I'd really be surprised if there isn't a possibility of having a racist attitude in every community that is represented in this room. And if you, I think the thing to think about is whether or not there's a group in your community, can be white, it can be people that are blind, mentally ill, people from prisons, can be a poor group, all different kinds of groups. What is your attitude for those people? And how do you, what kind of attitude do you show, if you have children, show towards those people that your children can watch? And how are you teaching them to interact with those people? I was reminded of that when we came to the Chelan, and it was my kids that reminded me of it. They said, gee, who are these dirty people that are walking around Chelan? And they look like Mexican Americans. And And I said, yeah, they're probably migrant workers picking apples and cherries and so on. And so I think that the attitude can be formed within your communities, and what you, you know, how you respond to those groups in your community. And that will enable them, empower them, to respond to blacks, or Chicanos, or whoever it may be.
I think that one of the important distinctions which we must make is learning and even beginning to appreciate the cultural differences of other people, which some of them you may not even ever be assimilated to them. Some of them you can assimilate into your own culture and it can actually mature. And as I indicated, cultural aspects per se on their own are not an ideological force in the sense of being used to preserve certain status, to justify certain things, or to give a very dogmatic or totalitarian viewpoint. It's just they are as they are. It could be because of certain influences, whether a person comes from Eastern Europe or from Asia or from Africa. They are the effect, they are there. But when you deal with racial issues, which I think racial issues more than anything else deal with power issues. And you can educate a person to begin to appreciate a particular cultural aspect. But when you deal with racial issues, as I said, are to me more inherent in the sense that even if you can do away with them, they will arise the day one wants to have an up position on the other. And then he can just pick up on a particular difference and begin to use it to say, yes, this is, I'm entitled to this because we are of this, and begin to use it ideologically as to preserve his position, and they are dealing with this. Now that is why I say that I acknowledge the importance of an education process related to racial differences, and I acknowledge the importance also of intermingling with people of different races. But more than that, the only way to counter racial institution is through another imposing power, which can be gotten from the people. Like I said, that a constitutional things are the most important. What I see as the serious danger is to assume this kind of society that Lowe indicated, that we are colorblind here. There is no racism, because that is the important danger. It may not be there at that particular point in time, but it can just resurrect tomorrow. That is why that vigilance to counteract it needs to be there forever. Racism is like sin. It's not something that you can say you have rooted it out completely and absolutely. Because the day competing interests emerge, the first thing they will want to use to justify themselves will be those apparent differences between people. It could be religious, it could be sex related, gender related, it could be color related, etc., etc.
So, in some of the experiences that we've had, I've been in several kinds of schools in the United States, and also in international schools, elementary and secondary education. And in one of the schools that I was in North Africa, it was two different times, and primarily the first time it was 90% Americans. It was a very fine school then, but later in returning, it became much more international. And the tremendous effect that I think it had on all of these different students, 50 nationalities were represented, they were taught through the American curriculum, mostly by American teachers, but it was a school that just thrived on this different cultures being together. The students, there was not one predominant group at all, and they just had a tremendous blend. And the parents got together in various social activities at school through sports, after school, music, the arts. Everything seemed to work really well, and there was no bias of any kind that we could see. For our own children, it was one of the greatest things that could have happened to them in living in the world which we have today. And of course, there were things that could have come up and did at times, but it was resolved by this group really working together. And it was one of the finest experiences that, we had as a family and working in a school such as this. That maybe is not so realistic that we might find in our own localities, but it does show what can happen when many people do get together, children and their parents, their different cultures, working and living in a different country.
And the ones who were there in the early years, when it was 90% American and 10% not American, and then later it became the exact reverse, 90% non-American and 10% American, they found that the blend of all these many cultures was far more exciting and far more enriching to everyone's lives there. Everyone felt that, it seemed as though the entire community felt this wonderful blend of different cultures and felt that they were terribly privileged to be a part of it. And it was beautiful to see it working there. Perhaps we were in a very unique situation, but it worked there.
Our board felt, they wondered every once in a while and would ask me, don't you think that our children, meaning the Americans or Canadians, will probably suffer from having an education that would be diluted somewhat, because we had many that did come in who were, English is not their first language. Invariably, those children, if they were there long enough, would end up very often being at the top of their class, because their intense interest in an education was there, and that helped everybody.
It raised the standards instead of lowering.
So it was a situation that really was very revealing to us and to those that were in that situation.
No, thank you. We will take two comments or three comments, and then I'll bring this to a close up because we've got a few minutes. Yes. Thank you.
I don't know. It seems to me that one of the things we need to talk about in terms of thinking of racism, that it does pervade the whole, that everyone is affected one way or the other. I don't think anyone escapes it. And I also think there's a way of thinking about how one deals with it, understanding that we have, then this is my perception, this pervasion of our lives in terms of what, if we believe that all people are God's children, for example, something as simple as that. I mean, what are those beliefs that we put into practice wherever we are? I mean, if we really believe that, or do we feel there is one group that is superior versus another group is superior, inferior? Where is the balance? I live in an intentional community. I live in an intentional community in Chicago, on Woodlawn Avenue, in the community of Woodlawn, which is all black. Our intentional community is a covenantal community, and it is meant to be intergenerational, interracial, interclass, enter whatever else you can think of. It is hard work. There is no doubt about it. This day in and day out living is not easy. Cultures clash all the time in our community. I get resentful myself when I think I have to act just because I'm white, I have to be more black than white. And I keep thinking, well, you know, why can't somebody like what I like at times? And I know that that happens in all of our families, in our intentional community. It's not just me. We're trying to live together. It isn't easy. And sometimes I gotta have a break. And sometimes it's nice to see homogeneous faces, but I don't like it a long time either, because there's something funny about that to me. All I'm saying is that it seems to me that there's something about in thinking about what's bigger than even our living together or thinking about it, is that what is our relation to God and to people? Mm-hmm. And it has to be something bigger than what I feel, because what I feel, I'm pretty racist at times, that adjective. yeah. And I don't think I'm alone.
Thank you for raising that, because as I say, I'm going to try and develop this ethics of hospitality to the stranger, which mm-hmm. basically is a concept that is emerging on the American scene, to say, as Christians, how do we respond to the implications of the other who's completely different in our midst, who is simply here and is totally different, what is it? And the implications of the other is a lesson for tomorrow. And then the final response is the ethics of hospitality to the stranger, which is part of what you are raising, which is part of living your life in cognizance of people who may not even share the culture that you have as strangers in it, and how do you accommodate them? Well, the final one.
I was just going to say that I taught in Southeast Portland, and we have fewer blacks, but we've always had good positive relations with them. One family was just a delight for all our children. They were very musical, and the parents came and participated in the PTA. We had nothing but good response there. So I was going to say that I could relate with these folks over here on that.
Thank you very much. And as we draw this lesson today to an end, let me congratulate you all for facing this issue directly.